yards are all filled once the last Palestinians killed. On Manhattan Island, in the halls of the UN, the whole world will come together to say never again. They'll open a museum full of relics of the past before those who used to live there resisted to the last. We'll look at pictures of the rubble with the dead limbs poking through. The viewers will shed a tear and wish the leaders knew before the war ended in the way Ben-Gavir had willed once the last Palestinians killed. In the parliament, they'll say, perhaps we should have listened instead of purging Europe's biggest party of internal opposition. Should have paid attention to the millions in the streets, to those massive crowds around the globe voting with their feet. Should have read the signs, should have listened to their words instead of denouncing all the talk of genocide as just absurd. Should have looked at the pictures of the bodies charred and grilled once the last Palestinians killed. When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war, when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled once the last Palestinians killed. When the project is complete and they make the desert bloom, once they finish turning cities into tombs, once the dead are out of sight and buried in the ground, once the rubble has been bulldozed and no one hears the sound of dying children screaming from somewhere down below, once the shopping malls are gleaming and no one needs to know how many babies' bodies are in this soil that we've tilled, once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, on January 7th, Ecuadorian gang boss Adolfo Macias escaped from prison, embarrassing the recently elected tough-on-crime president Daniel Noboa. Since then, paramilitary raids and assassinations of public figures, one notably killed on live television, have ping-ponged, marking an escalation of violence that at first paralyzed and continues to terrorize the South American nation. Joe Emmesberger is a Canadian-Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Joe's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur English, among other places. Welcome back to the program, Joe.
Yeah, great. Thanks for inviting me, Chris.
It's always my pleasure. Now, Joe, we last talked in August during the violent run-up to Ecuador's presidential election, and where there were assassinations of political figures, right, left, and center, it seemed at the time. Joe, did that the violence then and the political assassinations that occurred then contribute to the bloody state of things that we're seeing now?
Well, this has been developing right since the Correa left office, and his successor, who actually won the election that year as a Correa loyalist, he did a very remarkable and cynical U-turn very quickly, within weeks, I mean, of taking office, and basically became a right winger. Just like, I mean, I say when Lasso won in 2021, it was really like he was winning a second term, because Moreno went full speed ahead to criminalize the Correa's movement, to basically do the opposite of what he did in every aspect, economically, in foreign policy, everything. And one of the fateful things is that he undid Correa's very successful, and I must stress, very successful crime reduction policies during his 10 years in office. So, you know, Ecuador, for a lot of reasons, from 1980 all the way through till 2011, you saw that we see that Ecuador's homicide rate was constantly increasing. It steadily increased from like probably around six or so deaths per homicide deaths per 100,000 in 1980 till about 18 or so by 2011, the first few years of Correa's time in office. But by the time Correa left office, the homicide rate had fallen to 5.8 per 100,000 deaths. That's in 2017. So it reduced by two thirds, and just a total reversal of the long-term trend that had been going on in Ecuador. And that's ever since he left office and Moreno did this U-turn, it's just gone back up again. And now it's over 46 deaths per 100,000 people. It is the highest it's ever been, perhaps ever, certainly in terms of the past 80 or so years where there's even statistics that are all reliable on that kind of thing.
Well, is the nature of the violence now, Joe, is this mostly gang violence
there is organized crime. This is driven largely by Ecuador, because of its, like I said, this is a long-term problem. This was a problem that was growing before Correa for decades. Ecuador's proximity to Colombia, which is the major, as everyone knows, drug cocaine producer. And so that proximity to Colombia has been bad for, I'd say it's been bad for really all of Latin America, not just Ecuador, but especially the closer you are, it just stands to reason that it's going to be more of a concern. And it takes a government that, like Correa's, that had a real belief in the state being powerful and the state being efficient and serving people. But the neoliberal idea, the capitalist idea, is basically the opposite, that the state should be basically just there to protect rich people and nobody else. And that's basically the constant weakening of the state that took place from 1980 till Correa's time in office. And then afterwards, when Moreno did this reversal, same idea. You weaken the state. And when you weaken the state, you have like an analyst I talked to recently from Ecuador, David Villamar, he told me when you weaken the state, you have these parallel structures of power that fill the vacuum. And in Ecuador, that's what's happened with a lot of organized crime, drug lords, what have you, taking over the prisons, taking over the ports, just having a free for all, just doing what they want. And it's exploded into such obvious humiliating scenes for Ecuador's elite at this point, where you see drug gangs taking over a TV station and stuff. It's obvious that they're running the prisons, they're assassinating people, they're just running wild because there's no state that's been willing to confront them. Just to give you an idea of how horrible it's been, I mean, Noboa, the new president, is trying to show that he's at least willing to confront. Now it's gotten to such a point where he really has no choice but to call out the army and try to take on the violent gangs directly. They're just all over the place, and they're making life hell for everybody. So he's been forced to call. I think any government of any ideological persuasion would have to do what Noboa did initially, is to try to get just confront them with armed force and try to get some semblance of control. I mean, one straightforward measure that he's been doing, that he's been getting some praise for, is that they cut the internet cables to some of the prisons to leave the criminals inside without internet. But if you think about that, why would these out of control prisons, why wouldn't that measure have been done years ago? You know, and the answer is that they've managed, the organized crime elements have managed to infiltrate all kinds of institutions. And it has to reach this unbearable point before the government's forced to just do the most basic stuff to try to get things under control.
Yeah, well, I mentioned off the top that there was an assassination on a live television show where these guys just stormed into the TV station, shot somebody dead. The guy that was in charge of the investigation of that, Cesar Juarez, himself was assassinated a week ago while he was just sitting in his car in traffic. They just walked up and killed him as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the one, the assassination, there's been all kinds of assassinations of lower level political people, non-political people. Everyone's been touched by it. But the assassination that had the most electoral impact was the assassination of the very anti-Korea politician, Fernando Villavicencio. He's a former journalist, very sleazy, very unscrupulous character, right-wing character. But he was assassinated, and the Lasso's government at the time and the president, attorney general, she's been the attorney general since 2019. She's basically presided over the whole disaster. And they did everything they could to insinuate that it was Korea or Koreaists who were involved. And only now it started. Now everyone's pretty much common knowledge that he was. The story has not been totally fleshed out completely, but it looks like the most likely thing is that he was killed by drug lords who he was probably trying to intimidate to say, hey, I'm gonna if you don't give me money, I'll get you bad press. Because Fernando, since Correa left, he's one of these guys who's had the power to basically give people bad press if they don't do what is expected of them. And it looks like I can't prove this, but it looks like everything points like that. Something like that happened where he was trying to extort dangerous people. and they decided, you know what, we're just going to bump you off. So it was something like that. But the cynical thing, the incredible thing was that now everyone pretty much admits it was some kind of drug related, some kind of a crime like that, of that nature. But when it happened shortly before the election, that there was a disconcerted effort to try to pin it on Correa and on Correa's people.
Yeah, and that was the Correista, Luisa Gonzalez.
Yeah, she was the candidate. Yeah,
and she was
the reason she's the candidate. Well, because Correa is in Belgium with political asylum. He can't return. I mean, the political persecution over the past several years has been very extreme, and it's related to the crime problem, because you have a judicial system that's very corrupt, where it's all just about persecuting the Correaists and basically neglecting everything else and weakening the state. So it's all tied together. This whole disaster. It all stems from basically becoming a right wing government that's only preoccupied with protecting the rich, criminalizing any opponent they see as dangerous to them, and that nothing else matters to them but that. And they've let this violent crime problem just blow up. And now Noboa, even though he's also a right winger, despite some of his rhetoric, he's being forced to at least do something to try to contain the situation.
Well, the Financial Times has a pretty extensive interview inside the Ecuadorian port city fighting a drug-driven crime wave, and it's talking about the cartels that have moved into the drug trade. They've got just talking about the murder rate, they've got a graph here that shows Ecuador's murder rate is almost double of those in Mexico and Colombia. But Mexico plays a big part in what's going on there right now with the Sinaloa cartel moving into Ecuador in a big way. What do you know about that, Joe?
Well, the specifics are hard to keep track of. There's a whirlwind of information, but the thing that people have to take away is, look what happened during Correa's government. Why was there this two-thirds reduction in the homicide rate? I mean, I can tell you myself, I traveled all over Ecuador with my family on the highways, all over the place. First of all, the highways were dramatically improved, but we had nobody in my family had any fear of being assaulted or anything. It was very safe, and I can remember, because I traveled Ecuador frequently, that years earlier that was not the case. When during the 90s, early 2000s, everyone was very worried about getting mugged, about getting you were very careful. And the only time I remember feeling that my family was safe, it wasn't when I was a young man visiting my family in the early 80s. Because what's happened since then, I think David Villamar explained to me when I talked to him recently, is that, basically, like you mentioned, these cartels internationally, over time, they just have a lot more money. They're a bigger business, and their business is now booming to a far greater extent than it ever did during the 80s. So that gives them, if there's a vacuum, if there's a place that's weak, that allow them to have their, you know, get their way, then they'll move there and they'll operate there. And that's why, I mean, when Correa was in office, I mean, Correa took office first in 2007. By then, this drug business was, you know, very well developed. But he was managed able to wrestle it to the ground and keep Ecuadorians safe, because you needed a much expanded government. You had three of the ministries you had, or at least two or three of the ministries you created for security have been eliminated by under Moreno. They have this belief that you chop the state down, like kind of like Milei is doing in Argentina. This psychotic thing. No, we got to weaken the state. You have to bring the state down to its bare essentials so that all it does is basically just protect rich people. But in Latin America, it's such a toxic variety. It doesn't even protect rich people. Ultimately, it becomes such a free for all and so dangerous that even people with money are afflicted by this.
Oh, heaven forbid. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joe Emmisberger. He's a Canadian Ecuadorian engineer journalist. He's the co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. His articles are published at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur, among other places. We're talking today about Ecuador and the current crime situation. It looks like chaos. It looks like mayhem. When you talk about Correa having maybe an easier time in 2007 taming the gangs and the gang violence, today it seems out of control, except for in places like El Salvador. I talked last week about that, Joe, and about the leader there, Bukele's so-called state of exception. Do you know what that refers to?
I haven't followed Bukele much, so I don't want to comment too much. But there has been a reduction in violent crime in El Salvador, but I don't know what the trade-offs have been in terms of human rights abuses and stuff like that. You have to bear in mind what Correa achieved in Ecuador. Not only did he achieve this two-thirds reduction in the homicide rate, you know, which was unprecedented in its decades, but he achieved it without mass incarceration, without the death penalty, without extraditing people, extraditing Ecuadorians to the U.S. or stuff like that. So he and by expelling the U.S. base from Manta, the U.S. had a military base in Ecuador that Correa got rid of by 2009, and that's one of the things they say. Oh, he got rid of the base that caused a violent crime. As if people, yeah, it's really a dumb argument. The violent crime collapsed after they got rid of the base in Ecuador, and also of course Colombia has all kinds of U.S. military presence, and they've been plagued with tremendous crime, insurgency, everything else. So I don't want to comment too much on Bukele, but I just want to point out that Correa's policies were effective. I mean, they definitely involved using police. But he also filtered out corruption in the police. He had the police to be police. You had to take polygraph tests. You had to have extensive background checks and stuff that he introduced that was unprecedented. All that's been dismantled. All that's been dismantled since he left office. So it's been a free for all. It's just been just a great environment for these very wealthy organized crime groups to start infiltrating and start getting their way.
Well, according to my guests last week, the state of exception is the exception to the Constitution and the rules of democracy as we understand them in the West for that country, specifically to fight these gangs. And yeah, the costs have been very high in human rights, and all those things you mentioned, of course, have come into play. And thousands, tens of thousands of perfectly innocent El Salvadorians have been arrested and put in these mega max prisons that have been built, as well as political opponents, union organizers, and the kinds of things that you would expect. The reason I mention it, though, Joe, is because other countries in the region are looking to El Salvador now and saying, oh, well, maybe we should be doing that. Is there any talk of similar to that in Ecuador right now coming out of the government?
Of course. Yes. I mean, they'll always look for some kind of so-called, which is really, really infuriating, because they had an incredibly successful approach that worked wonders for 10 years. And that did not involve mass incarceration, did not involve all these human rights abuses, did not involve the death penalty or police running around shooting people. It just involved very smart, basically cleaning up the judicial system. It involved the judiciary too. It involved reform to the judiciary. And he got, you know, these groups that are now, like Human Rights Watch is disgusting. They're telling the, for example, they're issuing statements to Nabil, oh, be careful with the state of exception, which is, I mean, it on its surface is valid, but Human Rights Watch was a really belligerent critic of Korea's government. And they were praising Moreno and for all the horrible things he did, basically for creating, they were praising him for creating the catastrophe that Ecuador is now living through. So, yeah, I mean, of course, the right wing likes to point to a so-called successful model from a right-wing country, but also they'll distort and lie about and ignore as much as possible the successful model that they had in Ecuador under a left-wing government.
Well, yeah, and the idea that the prisons too now are basically owned by the gangs, that members of opposing gangs are being murdered.
A basic thing like splitting up the gangs is something that they haven't been willing to do. They've actually put the gangs together. You know, you want them together. I mean, just the most basic things, the most basic controls of just because of corruption. And again, and linked to that, the ideology of just weakening the state, giving the state fewer resources. It's all together. It all links together. And also the judiciary and the whole legal system preoccupied with political persecution rather than prioritizing, you know, defending their people.
What have the Americans had to say about this? I know they get their noses into everybody's business in their backyard.
It's been an excuse. Like you say, it's been an excuse now where Ecuador is signing agreements with probably unconstitutional agreements that they've just recently signed for security cooperation with the United States. Well, it'll be it'll be a bonanza for the, it has been already for years, but it's going to be with under the cover of helping Ecuador fight crime. They're already situating themselves as if they were, as if Ecuador were once again a colony of the United States. They've recently, like I said, the Constitutional Court, which was fired and replaced under Moreno to make sure it was right wing enough. They've been approving all these deals that Noboa even recently made with the United States, so that they get their noses in basically overseeing Ecuador's legal system.
Yeah, well, again, to the point of the Americans saying that, or people in Ecuador saying, when an American base was removed, this would increase gang activity. Where we know in Colombia, being the perfect example, that wherever the American influence is, the drug business goes up, not down.
Well, look at El Salvador. I mean, what was the United States doing in El Salvador for decades? I mean, where did the gang problem come from? It came from a civil war fueled by the United States trying to prop up a fascist dictatorship, you know. And then you had when you had demobilization happen, right? You had a lot of people with guns, you know, basically direct their attention to crime, you know, because they had death squads before, right? So if you look closely at any country in Latin America, you can see what a toxic influence the United States has had constantly throughout the last few centuries.
Yeah, and the dirty wars in the 80s were especially brutal, and it created there's been now the gang situation in El Salvador created a massive emigration. Is there been any sense of that? I know Ecuador is much further away from America, but has there been an exodus from the country of this?
Yes, because of this and because of the horrible. It's got, I mean, there's been a 13 point increase in poverty. The poverty rate. The poverty rate's increased dramatically, especially with COVID. Ecuador had a horrific COVID response. And with all lousy economic policies over the last 7 years, their poverty rate has increased, and insecurity. It's all fueled. There's been like a second major wave of migration. There's this place called the Darien Strait, that's where people from South America cross into Central America, migrants. And Ecuador is second, I think, to Venezuela in terms of number of people crossing that area, because in Ecuador, you have to bear in mind, it's not only further away from the States, but has half the population as Venezuela. So when their migration numbers are comparable, that tells you how bad it is.
Well, so what, Joe, we're fast running out of time. What prescriptions are or is the government offering right now? Then they've brought out the military. Is that it?
You know, aside from bringing out the military, they're gonna go for right wing type, like kind of a Bukele type approach, right? They're gonna want to clamp down on human rights. Basically, they're gonna want to extradite Ecuadorians. That's another thing that the right's been trying to do. They failed to do under Lasso. They're trying to do it now. They're trying to get a referendum, maybe question to get to see if they can legalize extraditing people to the United States. So stuff like that. It'll be basically try to legitimize a right wing approach and anything but the approach that actually worked for 10 years and had you know fantastic results.
Well, it looks like the new president is in for a short trip but a bumpy one. Well, yeah. Well, Joe, before we go, there was since we last talked and actually quite recently. I mean, we have talked in the past about Alex Saab. He's been released. Do you want to briefly remind listeners who Alex Saab is and the status of his liberty right now?
Yeah, Alex Saab was actually absolutely horrendous. I wrote about it for fair.org a few years ago. He was arrested despite being a special envoy, a diplomat for the Venezuela, which should have granted him immunity. He was traveling to Iran to make deals to help Venezuela bypass economic sanctions, which are devastating to the population. So he was trying to help them working as a diplomat, and he was illegally arrested in Cape Verde, off the coast of South Africa, basically, and illegally arrested, and then ultimately they have an extradition. It was all illegal from start to finish. You can get into the legal technicalities, but it was just an abomination from every legal angle you can think of. And he was ultimately imprisoned in the United States. And what they finally worked out, because of all the problems the United States has, its foreign policy really under stress all over the world because of its own belligerence. So now it worked out a deal with Maduro where he released a bunch of basically U.S. citizens who have been involved in coups and whatnot. And he released them in exchange for Alex Saab and got him back to back to Venezuela. It was a big victory for anyone who cares about human rights and human decency. It was a big victory. Fortunately, Alex Saab is now back with his family.
Well, that's good. And he was also a cancer survivor and sufferer still, as far as I understand.
Yes.
Yeah, and Lenin Moreno, too, damnable because of his turning over Julian Assange to the American authorities. And Julian Assange just next month will be facing his final opportunity to defy American extradition in a British court. And I'll probably be doing something about that. Right. Joe, thanks a lot for coming back on the show again. It's always interesting to get a view of other part of the world that we don't usually get much information about up here.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. Thanks, appreciate it.
All right, until the next time, and thanks to Eve Engler for coming on. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time, thanks, Joe.
See you, Chris. Bye-bye.
When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war, when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled once the last Palestinians killed. When the project is complete and they make the desert bloom, once they finish turning cities into tombs, once the dead are out of sight and buried in the ground, once the rubble has been bulldozed and no one hears the sound of dying children screaming from somewhere down below, once the shopping malls are gleaming and no one needs to know how many babies' bodies are in this soil that we've tilled, once the last Palestinians killed, once the last Palestinians killed.